This is David Duke, broadcasting to the world on Web Radio. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may live upon the earth. And as I always say, this program is vital for all people because the essence of the ideas presented here at DavidDuke.com, the essence of the idea that I preach all over the world is that every people has a right to defend its own heritage, to preserve its own way of life, to protect and preserve and enrich its own identity, its own values, its own characteristics, and that no nation should be able to control other nations. People have the right to control their own destiny, and they have the right to live. Every people has that right upon this planet, and that includes the European people. And today I'm going to focus on some issues of the European part of humanity. I just came from a trip to Belgium, and we had a fantastic conference there hosted by Chris Roman in Dendermonde, Belgium. The conference was called the Euro Conference, and it was Euro-Rus Conference, which was a conference about the need for more cooperation between Europe and Russia, that Russia is a great repository of European mankind, and that we have natural alliances and a natural connection with the Russian people. And we see that the media, often, again, with the powers of international Zionism influenced by that power, we see the media taking a very anti-Russian position. We continually see Russia being attacked in the media. Oligarch thieves such as Khodorkovsky and Berezovsky and Abramovitz and Gusinski are often praised and protected and promoted by the media. We see Russia accused of all kinds of crimes, like the recent poisoning that existed in Britain, even though there's not a shred of evidence that the Russian government had anything to do with that poisoning. And we believe that we must continue to keep our bonds, and that Russia today is one of the few breaks upon the power of the so-called neoconservatives who control the United States of America. And the neoconservatives, as a patriotic American, I believe the neoconservatives pose a threat not just to the rest of the world, but also a threat to my own people. In fact, they are the author of a lot of the immigration laws. Not in addition to the incredibly horrible Iraq war, they have been the absolute proponents of immigration policies which will destroy the European-American heritage in the United States. And they're pushing the same kind of policy around the world. So this conference was a very powerful conference. Nick Griffin was there, many other major speakers, and I think it was a great success. We got some media that attacked us, and we had some media that was surprisingly fair. And we had a good turnout. It was really a great meeting. I also addressed a student organization, and I will leave that organization's name anonymous and the location anonymous. I was going to give you the name of the city, but I think I'll even leave the name of the city. But I spoke before a very old student fraternity that's actually much older than 100 and over 100 years old, has great traditions as far as the Flemish people are concerned. And I spoke before them in a very ancient building, and it was just a great experience for me. The audience was enthusiastic. Afterward, they drank some good Flemish beer and had some great songs. In fact, they sang many of the songs around the world. They sang American songs and hymns. They sang Flemish songs and hymns. They sang German songs and hymns, British songs and hymns, French songs and hymns. It was just a fantastic experience, and the camaraderie and the sense of destiny was present in the room. Wonderful, wonderful meeting. So I'm going to play this speech for you. I'm not going to tell you where it occurred. I don't want any political repercussions. But these young men and women in this organization, I believe, will become the leaders of Belgium. These are all university, high university students, many of them in law, history, economics, government, and they thoroughly enjoyed the speech, and I was also very impressed. And at the end, I think I'll play you a little bit of the of their singing. I mean, the whole group, and this was about 75 young men and women, they were at long tables and drinking some Flemish beer, or some didn't drink, of course, but they were drinking some Flemish beer, and they sang together. And this, what you're going to hear after is some music and some songs that they themselves sang. They sound like a recording. It sounds so beautiful and so inspiring. Well, ladies and gentlemen, here's the talk, and I'll come back with you in a few moments.
Well, let me tell you that it is an honor for me to be with young men and women who are determined to preserve their heritage and their freedom in this country and across Europe. Tonight I'm going to talk about some issues that are critical to our survival as a people, as a heritage, and the survival of the things that mean the most to us in our lives. The important things that distinguish us and distinguish our kind of humanity in terms of our art and literature and music and architecture, our way of life, our faith, our traditions. But when you talk about the great achievements of Western mankind, you talk about the great achievements of European mankind, you're often claimed to be, in the media, to be a racist or to be a hater. And it's not hatred and it's not racism to love your people and love your heritage and want to preserve those ideals. And even if European mankind had not created the great art and literature and music and architecture and technology and even the democratic principles of freedom that the whole world has come to value, even if that were not the case, we still have a right to live. We have a right for our children to live as we've lived and our fathers and mothers have lived and their fathers and their mothers for thousands of generations back. We have a media that tells us how vitally important it is to preserve every kind of life on this planet, whether it be the great whale of the Pacific or the Rocky Mountain cougar or the great African elephant. And I agree with that assessment. I think that our ecology and our environment is under attack all over the world. But if it's important to preserve every breed and every kind of animal life, every kind of physical life on the planet, isn't it important, isn't it vital that we also preserve our unique kind of life? And it's not hatred for our people to want to live, to want to survive. The fact is that European mankind, and specifically the people of our European nations, and whether you talk about Europe itself or the descendants of Europe in North America, in the United States, Canada, or whether you talk about Europeans in New Zealand or Australia or South Africa or elsewhere around the world, our kind is in a situation, is in a position where we are literally being wiped off of the planet Earth. There's a lot of factors involved in this process. And I'm going to talk about some of those factors. And I'm going to say some things that are very shocking and scary. It should be scary to all of us. But I'm also going to offer you, I think, by the end of this lecture, this talk, some hope. Because things are changing in our world. What is the process of our dispossession? What is the process? One of the main aspects of our dispossession is the fact that we have a very low birth rate. Right now, the birth rate among European peoples all over the world, including Europe and the rest of the world, is approximately 1.2. That means for every two people, man and woman, they only have an average of 1.2 children. In other words, we're losing 40% of our population every generation. That literally means in 8 or 9 generations, a blink of an eye historically, because it took thousands and thousands of generations to make us as we are. In the blink of an eye historically, we are decimated. For every 100 people, in less than 8 generations, we go down to 8 people. We are losing our way of life. Plus, every European nation has massive immigration of non-Europeans into our homelands. And the population groups that are coming in have literally incredible numbers of children. Their population rate of growth is not 1.2. It's not a negative growth. It's a positive growth, often 3, 4, 5. If you combine the immigration and you combine the low birth rates for our people, what we're facing, ladies and gentlemen, what we're facing, and I'm talking, I believe, to many of the future leaders of this country and around the world, what we're facing is the ultimate genocide of our people. The word genocide means genocide, or the...
So he goes on, first he accuses...
...the genes. The destruction of the genes. The destruction of our specific kind of humanity. And ladies and gentlemen, we have a right to live. And ladies and gentlemen, that's why I'm here tonight. I'm here to affirm and to talk with you about the fact that we must, at this time, at this critical juncture of time in European history, we must dedicate ourselves to the right of our people to live. We have a media today that totally disregards the rights, the freedoms, even the values of our people. They don't even look at our people's existence as something of value. They do look at the existence of every non-European group as extremely valuable. As you know, they're always talking about human rights. But what about the human rights of our people? What about the human rights of the Flemish people and the French people and the other nations of Europe? Let's talk about that a little bit. I brought with me a copy of a clipping. Let me see if I can get it up here. I brought with me a copy of a clipping from the Associated Press, which I want to share with you concerning the recent riots that existed. And let me see if I can... I think I've got to take another... Here it is. The riots that existed in France. You remember that of last year. And here's a quotation from the article. This is from the Associated Press, November 4, 2005. Aubervilliers, France, marauding bands of Muslim youth set fire to cars and warehouses and pelted rescuers with rocks early Saturday as the worst rioting in a decade spread from Paris to other French cities. The United States warned Americans against taking trains to the airport by way of the strife-torn areas. A savage assault on a bus passenger highlighted the dangers of travel in Paris, in Paris's Muslim-filled and impoverished outlying neighborhoods, where the violence has entered its second week. An African immigrant attackers doused the woman in her 50s and on her crutches with an inflammable liquid and set her afire as she tried to get off of a bus in a suburb of Severin Wednesday, judicial officials said. The bus had been forced to stop because of burning objects in its path. She was rescued by the driver and hospitalized with severe burns. Justice Minister Pascal Clément deplored the incident, saying it caused him great emotion. Now, all over the world, after this incident took place, now let's get this incident straight in our minds. We have a situation where a gang of Muslim youths stop a bus. An elderly woman on crutches gets off the bus. They throw flammable liquid upon her and set her afire. They burn her alive. Now, all over the world, the mainstream media describes the rioters that existed in France as youths. At every opportunity, the TV news will only show the scattered and rare white communist throwing a firebomb while ignoring the overwhelmingly clear fact that the riots are driven by a racial motivation, a racial hatred against all things European. Once in a while, a little truth ekes out in the controlled media. The Associated Press article quoted makes it very clear who the rioters are, and it shows the brutality of the savages. And that's who those rioters were. They were savages who were turning centers of European refinement and culture and civilization into examples of some of the darkest horrors of Africa. Now, let me ask you a question. How do you think the mainstream press would have treated this story if white attackers had stopped a bus and an elderly, crippled black woman got off the bus and they doused her with gasoline or lighter fluid and they set her afire? How do you think the media would have reacted to it? Do you think the minister would have simply said, "I react to it with great emotion"? Or do you think the French government would have got on there and talked about the incredible racial hatred that exists among white people for minorities? They would have talked about the fact that the French government would use every resource to hunt down the criminals, the savages that would commit such a horrible and heinous act against an innocent person. You probably, even here, very close to Paris, didn't even hear about this act. I think most of the people in this room didn't even know this existed. Most people in Europe didn't even hear about it. But if it would have been a black woman victim of this attack, do you think it would not have been on the front page of every newspaper in Europe and every newspaper around the world about the heinous aspects of white racism or crime and the terrible reactions against the immigrants? You don't even know, even from this article, you don't even know the name of the woman who was burned alive. You don't know her name. But she's one of you. And she could have well been your mother, or your sister, or your daughter, or your loved one. If it would have been a minority, it would have been in every press story across the world, and they would have had interviews with the family and the pain they were going through, and her recovery would have been covered in the hospital. You see, the people who are controlling the media and the governments of our countries don't consider your form of life as important as they consider non-European form of life. I'll be frank with you. I consider all form of life important. I think every race has a right to live. I think every race has a right to pursue its destiny, has a right to control its affairs, has a right to run its own country. I'm opposed to America being in 57 countries with bases. I'm opposed to the Iraq War. I'm opposed to colonialism. I'm opposed to those things. But I also believe that as every people have a right to exist, so we also have the right to exist. But the governments of our respective countries, not only don't think we have the right to exist, they're actually pursuing policies that will wipe us off the face of the earth, destroy our very heritage and everything we hold dear. Because that's precisely what's happening in Belgium today, in Flanders today, in Austria, in Germany. It's the same thing that's happening in France, the same thing that's happening in Britain, Canada, the United States, Australia. There is no threat to the Turkish people. There is no threat to the African race. In fact, if you go to Nigeria today, it's all black. If you go to China today, it's all yellow. But if you go to Berlin, sometimes you'll think you're in Arabia. If you go to Antwerp, sometimes you'll think you're in Arabia. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, we are absolutely losing our heritage. We're losing everything that we hold dear. and everything really of value. And we simply have a right to live. And yet the media constantly portrays us as a bunch of evil, evil, evil people. And the truth is, our people represent the things that are good and decent. You know, we look at the crime rate that's changed in terms of the immigration. And the innocent people that are struck down in criminal behavior and violence and murder and all the rest of it. Was this a less civilized country years ago before the immigration? I think it was anything. It was a more civilized country. Was this a country of people hating each other and conflicts and our gang rapes or the abuse of women that take place? No, I don't think that it was. Obviously it wasn't. Was this a country that was the streets were the streets dirtier a few years ago? No, I think the streets were a lot cleaner, and it's true all over Europe. And did an individual have a better chance for a decent life for his family? A few years ago, a young working couple could afford to buy a home. But it's hard to buy a home now in our relative nations when you're having to support with your huge tax monies hordes of people who've never put a penny into the tax system. And you really can't blame the people who've come in. You know, you really can't. People will go to some place where they can seek a better life. If somebody has nothing in Turkey or nothing in Africa, and they can come here and they can get a nice apartment, and they can get all the food they can eat, and they can get all the nice conditions to live in a clean street, they're going to come. But your government has an obligation to protect you. And your media must be responsive to the needs of the people, the needs of your own country. It shouldn't be devoted to any foreign power, any foreign force. Now, the biggest question that people talk about, and I really believe everybody in this room is opposed to the massive immigration that's going on in Europe. I think that's absolutely a fact. I think we know that. I think everybody in this room wants to preserve European, Western culture, Western Christian civilization and culture. And I think everybody in this room wants a nation where you're free. You also want a nation of free speech. And I'm not going to say anything illegal here, but I guess the government would love to put me in prison. I'd love to put any of you in prison just for talking about how you want to preserve your culture. They're trying to wipe your people, wipe your race off the face of the earth. And yet it's illegal for you to say, no, I want to survive. I want to live. I want my kids to live. I want my kids to look something like me. But there's a huge amount of hypocrisy, ladies and gentlemen, and there's a huge amount. And in the academic community, we have tremendous amounts of hypocrisy, but I'm glad to tell you, I teach some in Eastern Europe, and it's changing. There's a lot of people now who are beginning to understand the truth. But the reason why they're beginning to understand the truth is not because the government's giving it to us. It's not because the media is giving it to us. It's because we're creating our own media through the internet and communication. Because there are literally millions of young men and women like you all over the world who are beginning to talk about these issues among yourselves, discuss them, read, study, investigate, and who are becoming invested in this fight. Now, we all are opposed to immigration, but I'm going to talk today about another issue, an issue related to it that's essential for our understanding of why our people are being destroyed. What's happening in terms of immigration is not some sort of natural phenomenon. It's just not something people often say, well, it's history. It's just the way things are coming out. It's a natural phenomenon. It's not natural. Up until 30, 40 years ago, no Western nation was threatened by immigration, even the United States of America. When I grew up in Louisiana, my country was 90% European American, 90% European American. And in the space of just 35, 40 years, we've gone from 90% to about 60% European American. Now, for all my country's history, we had a higher percentage. But in just 30 years, everything changed. It wasn't because suddenly people became liberal. There were groups of individuals who controlled and dominated our press, who had a tremendous influence in our media, who had an old score to settle with the European people. a very old score. And I can talk about the power of this people by starting to talk about something that you're all aware of, and that's communism, Bolshevism in the last century. Bolshevism was the first example of this individual people exerting their power on an individual or international level to achieve their agenda over the agenda of another nation. I'm going to start talking about an element here, and this is where the speech is going to get controversial, but it's something that needs to be spoken about. And immediately as I speak these words, some people might think, because of the media presentation, some people might think, oh, this person's an anti-Semite. An anti-Semite is someone who opposes, you know, all Jews or hates all Jews. But there is an element among Jews, what I would call an extremist element among Jews, that have incredible power in the world, in media, in government, in the economy, who are literally pushing certain programs that they feel will benefit them and in turn, harm people they consider to be their enemies. It started out in Russia. The world Jewish community looked at Mother Russia and the Tsar, and they said the Russian people are an anti-Semitic people. In Russia, the Russian Tsar passed the May laws, which restricted some of the Jewish commerce in Russia. It was admitted, I can quote from Jewish sources and Jewish books, where they talked about the fact that that Russia, they felt to be their enemy. And for many years, the Bolshevik movement in Russia was dominated, financed, and supported by these organized radical Jewish elements. The same elements, by the way, that created Israel. Let's talk about Israel a little bit, and then we can get back and understand what's going on with the Russian Revolution. Israel is a nation, unlike Belgium's allowed to be, or Flanders is allowed to be, or France is allowed to be, or Germany is allowed to be. Israel is a nation dedicated to the Jewish people, the Jewish heritage. To immigrate to Israel, you must be of Jewish descent. Palestinians who are born in that same land, I'm not talking about people who are not indigenous, Palestinians who are 90% of the country, by the way, in 1910, who are born in the same land, many can't even go back to the home and the land they were born in. But Jews anywhere in the world can immigrate to Israel. And their way will be paid by the government. They'll be set up financially. And they will live in a, quote, Jewish state. And the media in Belgium and the media around the world never gives one bit of trouble to the idea that Israel's a Jewish state. In fact, American congressmen all the time get up and say, boy, yes, I am dedicated to Israel as a Jewish state. They're not going to tell you, in fact, they won't even allow you to have a Flemish state. The idea of a Flemish state devoted to Flemish people, oh my God, I mean, that would be the end of the world. But Israel is okay to have a Jewish state devoted to the Jewish people, right? Now, what's some of the nature of the Jewish state? Okay, the Jewish state, for instance, does not even allow a legal marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. That's fact. A Jew cannot even marry a non-Jew legally in the nation of Israel. Do you hear much about that in the media? Do you hear much criticism about that in the media? You don't even know about it. Most people don't even know about this. Let me ask you a question. What would happen if tomorrow the nation of Belgium passed a law forbidding the marriage between a Flemish person and a Negro? What would happen? What would descend upon this country? They'd probably nuke you. I mean, you know it's true. But how does Israel get away with it? Okay, good question. How does Israel get away with it? It goes beyond just not allowing marriage. Listen to this. Not only are they not concerned in not allowing a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew, by Jewish law, a Jew cannot even marry another Jew, practicing religious Jew, who has one drop of non-Jewish ancestry. Now, that may sound crazy to you. I've got an article for Jewish Magazine, and it's called Not Jewish Enough to Marry a Cohen. And it's about a boy named Cohen in Israel who wanted to marry another Jewish girl from a Jewish family, practicing Jewish religion, but the state of Israel forbid the marriage because in her family, there was an ancestor back in the family who was not Jewish. And so the Israel would not allow this marriage. I often contrast it this way. You know, in Israel, the Kohanim, which is like the priest class, is what they consider to be the historical leaders of Judaism. They cannot marry someone unless they are pure Jewish 1,000 generations back. They demand absolute purity. In the SS of National Socialist Germany, which was the German elite racial group, they simply said you had to have 6 generations of purity. Israel is more radical than the SS was. But where's the criticism? Do you read any criticism about it in your local newspapers? Most people don't even know about this. In the United States of America, I must tell you this, the radical Zionists control our media, they control our government. And again, it's not all Jews, but it's an extremist element. Now, there's many sources, there are many, many sources in the world that tell us about the dangers of Muslim extremism. And let me tell you something, Muslim extremism is dangerous, especially in our countries. I mean, it's one thing for Muslim extremists to be over somewhere in the deserts of Saudi Arabia, but when they're in the streets of Ghent, then you might have a problem. But there's many articles about Muslim extremism, and that's a threat to the world and terrorism. You can read about it almost every day in your media. You can read about it, you can hear it on documentaries on television. But people don't hear about the threat of Jewish extremism, the elements of Jewish extremism. And ladies and gentlemen, the Jewish extremism that I can reveal to you and prove to you is far more virulent than any sort of Muslim extremism. Let me give you an example. There's an organization in the United States of America, and it's all over the world. In fact, it's in Europe, and it's very strong in Belgium. It's a lot of this organization in Antwerp and many other places here in Belgium. It's a Jewish organization. It's called Chabad Lubavitch. Chabad Lubavitch. The famous rabbi of Chabad Lubavitch is Rabbi Schneerson. Very appropriate name. But Rabbi Schneerson, he's dead now, but he was like their patron saint. Rabbi Schneerson wrote articles, many books. And he said specifically that Gentiles have inferior souls. He said that the purpose of the entire non-Jewish world, every non-Jew in the world, everything on earth, the entire purpose of the earth and every non-Jew, and this is his words, not mine, is to serve Jews. That's pretty extremist. That's pretty supremacist, I would think. They also say in their articles, and I can show you this, you can go to the Chabad Lubavitch website, they can tell you this. They also say basically that Gentiles aren't even human beings. You see, you and your wife or child or mother, you're not even a human being. And I'm not saying all Jews believe this, but I'm talking about a radical extremist group of Jews. And now I'm going to tell you how much power they have, okay? I've got a picture on my website, davidduke.com, which shows a meeting of Chabad Lubavitch rabbis, not somewhere off in the Negev desert in Israel, but in the White House of the United States of America. And they have Chabad Lubavitch rabbis, actually, they got so many Jewish staffers in the White House, they were brought in by Josh Bolton. Josh Bolton is the Jewish extremist, now head of White House policy. He's head of White House policy, and he brings the Chabad Lubavitch with their beards and their earlocks and the whole bit. He brings them into the White House, and they actually teach the other Jewish staffers in the White House. Now, these are Jews who believe that Gentiles are inferior creatures who have inferior souls and in fact aren't even human beings. And to show you, to illustrate the extremism of these people and the hatred, the racism that exists among this group, I can quote to you from one of the Chabad Lubavitch rabbis and leaders, who's their expert on mysticism, and his name is Yitzhak Ginsburg. Now, I'm going to quote to you, not again from some offhand comment somewhere, I'm going to quote to you from the largest Jewish newspaper of the United States of America. It's called the Jewish Week. The largest Jewish community in the world is in America, and the largest Jewish newspaper in the United States is the Jewish Week. Now, in this article, Rabbi Ginsburg is talking about how Jews are superior to the other people of the world, so infinitely superior, that the morality that applies to other people doesn't apply to Jews. Specifically, he asked the question. He said, if a Jew is sick and needs a liver, and I want you to think about this one. If a Jew is sick and needs a liver, is it moral to stop an innocent Gentile on the street and take his liver? And Rabbi Ginsburg answers, yes. According to Jewish scripture, it is perfectly moral because Jews are of infinitely more value than Gentiles. That radical extremist just said in the largest Jewish newspaper, with no criticism and with no coverage, that it's okay if some Jew needs a liver to take your sister's liver, or your mother's liver, or your brother's liver, or your liver, if they think a Jew needs it. I mean, some of you probably can't even believe what I'm saying now because it sounds too insane. It sounds too crazy. It couldn't be that some religious leader would have this much hatred and this much animosity toward us to say such a thing. But I can show you, and I can show you the article in the Jewish Week. And I can give you the exact quotes, the exact statements by Rabbi Ginsburg, the largest Jewish publication. Again, not off somewhere in the desert. And these are the Chabad Lubavitch rabbis that are meeting in the United States White House. I've also got pictures of them with the head of Ukraine today, Yushchenko. And they've met with most of the leaders of all the countries. And I'm sure that your leaders here in Belgium have had meetings with them. And yet they make the National Socialists very moderate. Let me ask you a question. I don't know if many people here have ever read Mein Kampf. I think it's forbidden books here in this country and around the world. I believe in freedom of speech for any principle. But I noticed when I read Mein Kampf, when I read this article about the liver, I went back and I reread part of Mein Kampf. And Hitler talks about the fact he was once in Vienna as a young man. And he encountered some kaftaned Jewish people with the earlocks and so forth. And he said in Mein Kampf, he asked a question. And he said, these people are quite different than we are. He said, is this a Jew? Is this a German? He basically said that the Jews are different than Germans. Like different nationalities. Is this a Jew? Is this a German? Jews like Ginsburg and the Chabad Lubavitch, they don't, you know, they make Hitler's comment look very minor. They say, is this a Gentile? Is this a human? You see? More radical than anything that Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, and yet there is not a word about this in the media. You hear nothing about it. You learn nothing about it. And these radicals and these extremists have dramatically affected the Western civilization. They dramatically affected Europe in the last century. Few people even understand their role in the First World War. It was dramatic. People don't even know the Balfour Declaration. The settling of Israel was part of the reason for the American involvement, for instance, in the First World War. They don't tell you about the role in communism. I've been in Russia. I was in Russia for a few years. I've done some teaching there, and I know a little bit about the Russian situation. But I learned about the Russian Revolution mostly in the United States of America by reading American documents during the Russian Revolution. And I discovered something that I found was absolutely shocking. All of you, you take history courses, and all of you have taken courses in school, and you've learned about, quote, the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution, right? That's what it's called, the Russian Revolution. Well, the chief American Army intelligence officer in Russia was a man named Major Montgomery Schuyler. And he sent back documents to the President of the United States, talking about the composition of the first Bolshevik government of Russia. And I remember I told you the Jewish community around the world opposed the Tsar. They wanted to overthrow the Tsar. They saw the Tsar as anti-Semitic, and they were supporting revolutionary movements. In fact, Jacob Schiff, in his own autobiography in the United States, admitted that he supported the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, which defeated the Russians, to weaken the Tsar so they could have revolution there for the Bolsheviks. Anyway, Schuyler produces a table of the entire first Russian members of the Russian government. And he says in his paper, he says, yes, the first government of Russia consisted of a number of different nationalities. And he says out of 384 commissars, the first government of Russia, over 300 of them were Jews. And of that number, 264 had come to Russia since the downfall of the imperial government, come from the United States, from the downfall of the imperial government. Like Leon Trotsky, if you remember that story, whose real name was Bronstein. And he goes on to say, he lists the ethnic groups, and he goes on to list, and he says, of this government, of the first Bolshevik government of Russia, there were 13 ethnic Russians. Does that sound like a Russian revolution? Or does it sound like an invasion? 13 ethnic Russians in the so-called Russian Revolution. And the same pattern can be seen. I just came from Hungary. And the Hungarians are very brave people. And in 1956, they fought the Soviet juggernaut. They went out in the street with their bare hands against the tanks. There's a people who love freedom. And I went through all the documents and everything, and it's amazing. The four leaders of the Bolshevik regime over the Hungarian people, the four leaders, Rakosi and all the rest of the four, were all Jews. The head of the secret police was, in fact, Peter was Jewish. Even the Russian that put down the revolution, and his Andropov, who was also, just came out, I was in Russia the day, they had a big Russian magazine, and they were talking about Andropov, and nobody knew he was a Jew, and they mentioned, now that they feel more powerful, they mentioned a big article saying that he has very deep and proud Jewish roots. In fact, his family's house, he was so rich and powerful, but revolutionary against the Tsar and against the Russian people, so rich and powerful, his house was so big, his house became part of the torture chambers of the KGB after the revolution. Andropov. So the entire mechanism, the 56 revolution, the oppression of communism, was all involved in these specific people who were not Hungarians, and they literally became the ruling class of Hungary. You can see the same pattern in Hungary back in 1917 with Bela Kun. Now, communism is a phenomenon that's exhausted now. But the driving force behind communism is not exhausted. But no longer is its center in Moscow. Its center now, I hate to say it as an American patriot, as an American who loves his country and loves his people, its center now is in the United States of America. Now I'm going to tell you some interesting, fascinating information. As you know, America is involved in the Iraq War. The Iraq War is often painted in your media as an American imperialist war. That somehow America is in this war for oil, or America is in because America wants to rule the world. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. This war has nothing to do with the interests of the American people. Nothing to do with American interests. This war has already cost America $500 billion. It's going to cost $1.5 to $3 trillion before we're finished. We haven't got a damn drop of oil out of this war. We've got higher prices. Are you paying more for gasoline and benzene today or less? You paying less than before this war started? Americans are too. This war had nothing to do with American interests whatsoever. We've had 3,000 die. We had 30,000 Americans. Now, we keep people alive a lot longer than we used to in war. We've got better medical techniques. But now we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of young men and even young women today coming back from Iraq with no face or no legs and no arms, blinded or crippled or maimed, emasculated. They come back not ever able to have a child again or ever even to know the love of a woman or their wife when they get home. It's a horrendous, horrible thing. It's hurt America all over the world. It's caused the death of 500,000 Iraqis. There were no weapons of mass destruction. That was a lie created by the so-called neoconservatives because they couldn't get America to go fight a war for Israel. They had to tell Americans that they were being threatened, so they made up a lie. The two top protagonists of the Iraq War, the two main leaders of it, were, of course, Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl. The neoconservative movement is as Jewish as a wedding in Israel. I can give you some of the names: Wolfowitz, Pearl, Wormser, Feith, Abrams, Scooter Libby. I mean, we could go on and on and on. Sounds like a bar mitzvah. And these radical Jews were the leaders of the so-called neoconservative movement. And they've led us into Iraq. Now, Pearl, who's probably the best known man who started the Iraq War, he collaborated with David Wormser, another Jewish extremist supporter of Israel, and Douglas Feith, in writing a paper called, an academic paper, called A Clean Break, A Strategy for Securing the Realm. And the paper called for war with Iraq. This was long before, by the way, the Iraq War. With Iraq, with Iran, and with Syria. But guess what? Ladies and gentlemen, these American officials, these Jewish extremists, wrote this paper, not for the United States. So securing the realm was Israel's realm. The paper was written for Benjamin Netanyahu of the Radical Party in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu. But they couldn't get America to go for this clean break by saying to the American people, we're going to have you go fight and die and take the treasure of America for Israel. And they were able to do it, ladies and gentlemen. They lied about the weapons of mass destruction. They lied about everything. And this thing has brought on more war, more terrorism, and it threatens Europe today. It threatens all of us. It's destructive. And there's going to be more war. They're trying to generate a war with Iran, a war which may completely unravel our civilization because the oil disruption... What do you think $200 a barrel oil would do to your economy right now? I know how expensive gasoline is here compared to the United States. Imagine if it was five times more. How would that affect your business? How would it affect your lives? How would it affect any sort of shipping, any sort of industry, any sort of business in your country? Worldwide economic depression, plus blood, terrorism, anger, a clash, a true clash of civilizations. Yet these radicals are pursuing this policy. And the world doesn't hear anything about these radical extremists who have brought the world so much blood and so much hate. Now I'm going to try to wrap this back in to the immigration issue for a second and to the communism issue for a second. Do you know where the neoconservatives found their ideological base? Believe it or not, in America, neoconservatism, that's the name of it, that's what they call it, was started by a man named Leo Strauss, who was, in fact, a Trotskyite. Their hero, their model, their man of the hour, their man of their dreams was Leon Trotsky, the same Lev Bronstein of the Red Army that killed tens of millions of Christians and Russians and other people in Eastern Europe. That's their model. That's what their neoconservatism is all about. And Protohints and the rest of them have the same communist roots. The world has flipped, ladies and gentlemen. It has totally flipped. It used to be we looked at Bolshevism to Russia, and America was supposed to be the land of the free. And now the Trotskyites are in control of America, and Russia is free, or more free. In fact, you can even go to the extent of the fact and talk about that today, you know, the Russians, under the Bolsheviks, operated torture chambers in Eastern European countries. And you probably read about the secret prisons that are run by the United States in Eastern Europe. And today, America, under these Trotskyite Jewish extremists, are now operating the same torture chambers, the same prisons that the Bolsheviks operating from Moscow before in Eastern Europe. And they ship people there. They don't even say who they are. There's no lawyer. There's no habeas corpus, no rights at all, and they torture people. Just as they did in Abu Ghraib. And I don't think this is America. I don't think this is the European way to torture people that way. You don't go and fight an army and then rape men and women. And this is not the spirit and the value of our Western civilization. So we have flipped. We have changed. But who is driving it on? What else have the neoconservatives done if they control America that much to get us in a war that doesn't benefit us and hurts Europe and hurts the whole world with terrorism? What else have they done? Because that's a lot of power to be able to do that. Well, they have a complete and total program for all of society. And they are the ones who are behind the so-called globalism, and they are the ones who are behind opening our borders. Now, my book, it's called Jewish Supremacism, and I document this. I document from mostly their own sources. They have promoted and supported the breaking down of all of the borders of Europe and America. They have absolutely led the struggle from top to bottom. In America, to show you how tenacious they are, even from before the restrictionist legislation in the 1920s, they were the primary people trying to overturn American immigration law. And today, the most powerful immigration group in America that supports keeping our border open and changing America from a European nation to a non-European nation is the Hebrew Immigrant Society. And they have a group of organizations called the Council of Jewish Presidents of Organization, which brings together the 52 of the largest and most powerful Jewish organizations in the United States of America, okay, together on the constant positions. And they are linked with groups like the Likud Party, parties in Israel that are absolutely racial, and they support the open borders of America. They are also supported, if you notice, by Hollywood. I mean, I know a lot of you. I mean, we live in a nation. I go to the movies quite a bit myself. But let me tell you something. The movies preach us an issue. The movies that you get, and a lot of the record industry, which is also controlled by the same extremists who support the nation of Israel, who don't allow marriages between a Jew and a non-Jew, and the same musical industry, the same publishing industry that tells you that if you want your children to look like you and your family and your way of life, that you're an evil racist. The same people that try to tell you you should feel guilty for white colonialism or whatever, or anti-Semitism, are the same people who are telling you that it's a sin to want to simply preserve your your beautiful and productive kind of life on the planet. When I discovered these things as a young man, I mean, I was shocked. I didn't know quite what to do about it. At first, I didn't believe it, but then I started reading and researching, and I start to realize that what's going on today has been a process that's been going on for almost 2,000 years in our civilization, in our process. And it's going on right now. And if they're successful, we will cease to exist and cease to live. But we've got to. And you don't have to say everything all the time politically. I mean, I got 65% of the white vote in some races in Louisiana. And I had the huge amounts of media against me. It was pretty amazing, the races we had there. When I ran for governor and senator in the state of Louisiana, you never saw anything like it. And I want to tell you this because I think I can encourage. The media for years was saying, nobody likes David Duke. You know, he's a former Ku Klux Klansman. Now, I know some of you might have seen some pictures already with these white hoodie caps and things like that. You know, but you have to understand, I'm from Louisiana. We have Mardi Gras down there. And sometimes we dress up. But people, you learn of the world, you know, you learn of the world by the same media that defends Israel. They try to make any movement for national survival around the world for white people. They make them out to be racist, haters, killers, or whatever. And the group I was involved with, the Klan group as a young man in Louisiana, you know, there was never a single member of my organization anywhere in the United States who was ever charged with an attack against the minority. Not a single member. If they would have been, they'd have broadcast it all over the place. Not a single member. Never. It was an organization dedicated to defending our heritage. But the way the media portrays it, and by the way, that was now almost 30 years ago. I hope I don't look that old. But that was almost 30 years ago. Almost 30 years ago. Now, since that time, I got elected to the House of Representatives. I got elected to the most powerful Republican chairman district in Louisiana. I got my full doctorate, and I became a teacher, and I've got some of the best-selling books in the world now on many of these subjects all over the world. But every time I come into a city somewhere and I have to deal with these extremist media, the first thing they say is, Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, like it was yesterday. In fact, they mention it so much, I feel like I'm going to have to add it to my birth certificate. Now, why do they say this? I mean, George Bush has a history of using, you know, cocaine. But when they introduce him in the media, they don't say, George Bush, former cokehead. And I understand you have some high ministers in your own government here in Belgium used to be Bolsheviks, communists. I mean, communism killed more people than any other phenomenon in the entire world, didn't they? Right? But they don't say, former communist, every time they go on. They maybe mention his background. It's like this, ladies and gentlemen. If they like you, the media can do anything they want. If they like you, they'll say, here's what, if I would have become a sellout, and I would have simply gone away and become maybe a liberal, or changed my position, or become pro-Israel and pro-Zionist, instead of saying former Klansman, the media would say, isn't it great David Duke can overcome his past? You've got to realize, and I've learned long ago, that anybody the media despises is our best friend. Anybody they really love, watch out for them. You know, but people around the world are beginning to learn and to realize things. You know, I used to have some fun, you know, when they used to, you know, criticize me of being in the Klan, and I used to always make a joke about it. You know, like they'd say, well, you were in the Klan. And I'd say, yes, I used to be a wizard under the sheets. To show you the level of our enemies and how corrupt they are, when I ran for governor, I came very close to the governorship of Louisiana. The main slogan they used in the newspapers in Louisiana, in fact, the main slogan, they had bumper stickers, My opponent was a very corrupt politician who was indicted before from stealing from the people, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And but when he opposed me, when I was in the runoff, I defeated the sitting sitting Republican governor, became the Republican nominee. When they opposed me, they came out with a whole new slogan. They said, "Vote for the crook. It's important." I swear. They said, "Vote for the crook. It's important." You know, these are the people that believe in good government, right, and responsible government. Vote for the crook. Got to vote for the crook. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in a situation where we're struggling absolutely for our survival. And we've got to begin to recognize where it's coming from. You know, the biggest problem you have, even, is not even your politicians necessarily in your country. The biggest problem you have is the garbage, the propaganda that's coming out of Hollywood, with stuff that's coming over your airwaves to destroy your own sense of identity and heritage, to make you hate yourselves. And you've seen it. You've seen some of the liberals in your own university that really, they hate their own race. They say, well, it'll be great when there's no more white race. It'll be great when there's no more Flemish people. Oh, wouldn't that be great? Then we're going to have a world of love and brotherhood. Yeah, well, sure. Let's take a look at the world, right? Let's take a look at that world. The point is, there's always going to be some conflicts in the world. But our people have a great and a beautiful heritage, and we've got to begin to understand where this impetus is coming from. The same people who support the supremacist state of Israel are telling you that you don't have a right to live. That there should be no more children in the world like your children. All of you here are young. You're studying in school to be a doctor or a lawyer or historian or whatever. You're studying, you want to make a career. You want to make a life for yourself. You want to make a life for your family. You want to help your community. But if you don't get busy, if you don't get dedicated to changing the way the government's going in this country and the way Europe is going, there's no future for you. There's no future for your children. And all the sacrifices of your forefathers will be for naught. You know, Flanders has an incredible history, and I've been doing some recent, you know, reading about your history, and because I wanted to get a better understanding. And your people have always struggled for your freedom. You've had many times of occupation, such as the Spanish, Habsburg. Many times your people have been oppressed, but your people have never given up. You've survived. You've persevered. You're still here. And that says something for you, and it says something for your forefathers and your families. And you've suffered terribly. Countless Flemish people have been tortured because they resisted these governments. Countless Flemish people have lost their lives. Countless families have lost their lives. Even at the end of the Second World War, there was terrible things done to so many of the Flemish people. Horrible things done. And you're now at like a precipice, not just in your life, but in the life of your people. Because no matter what occupation, yes, some of the Flemish people were carted off to Spain to work, you know, as basically laborers. And some of the people in your country were carted off, in fact, at the end of the Second World War. And even during the Second World War by some powers, because for labor and so forth. But your people were always here. But now with the birth rates the way they are, and by the way, where's the birth rate coming from? I'm going to bring it right back to the same subject. Feminism brings that birth rate on, radical feminism, which is Gloria Steinem and Bella Asbug, Betty Friedan, and the media that promotes it. A liberalized sexual morality in our world that creates all kinds of diseases for people, and people become not as productive, destruction of the family life. What else does it? This love of mammon, this you know, we used to say, yes, we'd like to be rich, we'd like to have some more money, but used to be in Europe, we put things above money. We put honor above money and duty above money and beauty above money. Right? And what else is affecting? Affecting it also, this massive taxes you pay. I run into people all the time who are whether it be Flemish or whether it be Germans or whether it be Americans, and they say, you know, I'd love to have a child. I can't afford it, though. I'd love to have a kid. I'd love to have some children, but I just can't afford the damn taxes. Why? Where are those taxes going? And then, of course, you've got the immigration. The issue is, in 30, 40 years, if you don't do something intelligent and courageous, you are no longer going to exist. Even, look, what I'm talking about here is the most natural phenomenon, the most natural thing on earth, the willingness to survive. This is the drive of life. This is what took us from the swamps to a fantastic civilization and culture. This is what took us to the stars and will take us to the stars. I mean, even a cockroach will struggle to survive, will try to escape to live. Every form of life has this drive to live and survive. And you have it too. And you're going to have to develop it and fight for it and grab onto it and realize that in your life there is nothing more important than this fight. It makes any career idea that you have in the future, it makes any personal goal almost irrelevant. Your whole people are facing extinction. The values of thousands of years are on the edge of extinction. You have to. You must. From your heart and your soul and your spirit, you must rise up with strength and intelligence and dedication and self-sacrifice. I really believe that's ultimately what this club's about. Finally, there are a lot of people who believe that we cannot win. They say, well, the game is over. And I respect those people who have those intellectual decisions. And yes, it's very dark out there. It looks very, very dark. For Flanders, for Europe, for the United States. But ladies and gentlemen, the game is not nearly over. We have within us the blood, the genes, that took mankind's footsteps from the soil of this earth and put it on that object in the sky that man gazed up for ages with wonder, the moon. We have unlocked the secrets of the genome. We have unlocked the secrets of new energy sources. We have unlocked incredible achievements, as well as our beautiful aesthetic achievements. Our people, basically, well outnumbered, have conquered and conquered and conquered and conquered in the face of overwhelming odds. We are not beaten in the least. The only way that we will be beaten in this fight is if you accept the idea that we're beaten. The only way we will lose this fight, if you think there's no reason to fight, I'm going to go pursue my own little pleasures and forget about the fight, then we will be beaten. But I can tell you something. We are not. And you are not going to pursue that in your life. I know you're not, because I see it across the globe. I've been across Europe. I've been in every country of Eastern and Western Europe. I've been in the United States and Canada and elsewhere around the world, wherever our people dwell, and everywhere the spirit is rising. When we put our minds to our own freedom and our own liberation, our own heritage, our own preservation, our own survival, we will be victorious. And how do we do it? I can tell you the only way we can do it. The only way And I'm not going to say there's a rational way. We're going to find many rational ways. But the only thing that can save us at this point is our passion, is our spirit. And that passion's in your blood. It's in your heritage. It exists, it lives, it breathes in every breath you take. Dostoevsky, the great Russian author, said a wonderful line that inspires me very much. And he said, in the very darkest times of his life, he said, you know, only beauty can save us. Only beauty can save us. And I don't think he was talking about the idea that, well, beauty can save us. It's the idea of this vision of beauty, this vision of ideals. I have an ideal in my heart and my head of a society where our children are strong and free, where they learn honor and duty and courage, where everybody is educated to the maximum of their ability, where we have a society where people have good work, good morals, good values. I have an idea of a society that's continuing to make great scientific achievements. I have an idea of our people one day going across the heavens. I have this vision. And I have a simple vision in my heart of the beauty you find in your girlfriend, if you're a man, or in your boyfriend, if you're a woman. This beauty of your loved one. This beauty that expresses our own genes, our own heritage, this undescribable power that's in us. When you begin to focus on this, and when you say to yourself, I am not going to sit idly by while our people are wiped away. I'm not going to sit idly by while our freedom is wiped away. I'm not going to be on the sidelines. When you realize that it's not a burden for you to be in this fight, but a privilege for you to be in this fight. You young men and women, I'm not going to be here probably to see the fight to its conclusion. I don't know. Hopefully it will happen. It can happen in the twinkle of an eye, in the click of a finger. The world can change just like that. I might not see the end of it. But you young men and women, you can see it. You can live through it. You're going to live through the most exciting period of our entire history. You're going to be the ones who decide whether our people's long history is extinguished or whether we go to the stars. You're going to make that decision. You're going to be right in the middle of it. What an exciting, fantastic time of your life. I've paid my prices. I've been in the American gulag right shortly after I opposed the Iraq war. You know, I've been threatened by the communists, attacked by the communists. I've had my reputation slandered from one side to the other. In fact, it got kind of funny in the campaigns. I remember in one campaign, one week they were calling me a homosexual. Next week they were calling me a womanizer. I must have been pretty busy. But you're going to be on the absolute cutting edge. You're going to be on the line out there. You can live an exciting life, a dynamic life. And I urge you, and the last thing I'll say to you tonight, is that I urge each and every one of you not to view this effort and not to view the essence of what this club's about as a hobby. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's not like arguing about a puzzle or whether this a scientific approach to a disease is better than another scientific approach. We are talking about life. Here. We're talking about your life, your children, your country, your freedom, everything that's dear to people of true greatness. And the Flemish people are great people. And I'm proud to walk and be here among you. Thank you so much. This may be a Flemish beer. What an appropriate gift. Thanks so much. Thank y'all very much. What do you say we drink some of this beer now, huh? Thanks so much.
Tell you how inspired I was by the meeting, and I left that meeting with wings on my feet and a feeling so strong in my heart that our victory is inevitable. The spirit of our people is rising. The spirit is rising all over the world, and we are marching to victory. We're marching to justice. We're marching to the preservation of our heritage. We're marching to the enrichment, the ennoblement of our people. We're marching to our destiny across the world. I see the increase everywhere. I see the passion growing. And I believe that if we keep our hearts true and we keep our courage up, that we will eventually win this battle. We will change the world. We will rescue our people from the edge of the precipice, and we will indeed go to the farthest star. I appreciate your support. Your support makes possible this speech that you just heard and my work around the world. Some very exciting events are coming up very soon. I know that you'll be able to find them and follow them right here at davidduke.com. Thanks, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukedavidduke.com.